I think if you mostly focus on just scaling up, growing, and having volume, you have to think about the consequences of what might happen and how to prevent this. Because I think the most important, not just having the strategy, but having the mindset of what can happen. Because we all know that, unfortunately, we don't have any trust between people, and that's the reason why we're trying to protect ourselves.
Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I am the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com, where you take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features. But we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I have got Jane Ficina. Sorry, I knew I was going to get that wrong as soon as I... But anyway, Jane, I got Jane's second name wrong, from Modo Finance. And we're going to have an interesting chat today about Jane's experience into the world of being a fractional CFO, specifically focusing on modeling as well as other services. Jane, from her LinkedIn, has passions around being a fractional CFO as a service, is a Web3 advocate, and focuses particularly on startups, which is the people she likes working with. So I'm going to look forward to making fun of her, picking a terrible target market, because startups are always going out of business. So this should be a good one. Jane, you're very welcome to the show. Thank you very much for coming. Tell us a bit about you. Where in the world are you?
Thank you, James, a lot for a really warm introduction. I'm really glad to be here and share my experiences around and also share about my journey as well, being from being employed in a startup company, in the startup world, and ended up being as a founder of the agency where we help kind of startups with the financial modeling, or either they would need maybe something as a CFO as a services. So I started my journey being an intern in finance department, and it was the first company that I joined was TravelPerk. So they started being like, when I joined them, they've been 60 people, and then in 3 years I've seen the company growing to the unicorn level, and they had like around 600 people. And that was the place where I gained most of the experiences, going from account receivable, accounts payable, treasury, and then accounting, and then the FP&A part, which is financial planning analytics.
And you started off with an economics degree, from my memory, right?
It was something in between finance and the economic kind of degree, but it was mostly focused on the financial part. Because since I was a kid, I was into numbers, math, physics. So I loved it. And I just decided to kind of, you know, see if it's my passion in my life. And it's been like almost more than a decade, and I'm still like passionate about it.
So you went into a company that was growing very fast, which is why, you've got your passion for startups. And I guess when they started off, they didn't have much at all. How many people were in the finance team when you started? Who was it? And which areas did you get a chance to work in?
Yeah, so when I joined them, they had 4 people. So there was a manager in accounting, then CFO itself, then the girl that she was doing the account receivable. And then we had 1 person for treasury. So we probably had 4 people, so I was the 5th one. And because the company was growing so, so fast that they were not able to cover all the tasks on time, so I had to tackle them time to time within the different parts of finance. And that was the reason why, for example, I started from account receivable. And then because I was helping them, I was analyzing everything, making the structure. I was doing all the theoretical presentation in order for newcomers, when they come, they have all the information because they have a complicated kind of the business model. And then I went to accounting because they were lacking people there, and I really wanted to learn how to do the accountancy. So I was really like involved into different parts of finance. And then I ended up being in the FP&A, which is in finance department is one of the most important, because you do all the analytics of the company, you see all the issues, and you're trying to tackle from where it came from and how to solve it. So in 3 years, I went through the whole cycle, but then that wasn't the end. You know, I decided to quit, and that was COVID time, and I wasn't sure what's going to happen. And then I decided that to have a journey in accounting, but to have a full journey. And I got lucky enough, there was a startup called Buddy. And because that was COVID as well, they had only two people in finance department. So they were looking for the accountant that would do the whole cycle of the accountancy. So that's monthly closing, auditing, taxation, like everything. And that was something I was looking for, to get the whole spectrum of like accounting kind of theory behind. And I got lucky because my manager, my finance manager, she was from Deloitte and she was there for many years. And of course, she's the best like experienced person in accounting. And I'm glad I had this experience with her, because I gained so much experience that I was like kind of, you know, being ready fully.
Okay, so you mentioned there in your first role, you started off in accounts receivable. What was the business model there? What industry was it? What made it? You mentioned that it was a little bit tricky because of the business model. So what made accounts receivable an issue where they needed to dedicate someone to it?
Yeah, so they're on the travel industry side, but they're more on B2B. So which means when companies, they have any, like, you know, trips somewhere. So they book at trips at our platform. It's kind of the same as booking.com and Skyscanner, but then in our platform, it was combined all in one. So you register the company name and then all the payments, all invoices, they're all in one place. Also, some big companies, they have like five different entities, and you can create five different entities so that every country is aligned within the specific trips. So you don't have to go and classify them around. It's all already there. And the issue they had is they had few payment methods. One of them was bank transfer, which means for the month, you just book again and again, again and again. And then at the end of the month, you pay. But the issue was that we've been paying first and then the company was paying. And unfortunately, they had lots of fraudulent cases because they didn't think about the strategy of how to protect their funds, how to protect themselves as well from the fraudulent clients. And unfortunately, they had a huge, huge fraudulent companies that has been created in the system, and they've been approved for the bank transfer payment. And they had like, you know, 100 cases of fraudulent payments, which was incredible. And we've been trying to go to the court, but it's, you know, it's too late because nothing has been signed. So I would say at the beginning, it was a mess and hectic timing, but I was glad I went through this process and I've seen the company struggling. And I was there actually kind of helping how to protect and make this process more more secure. And this is what we've done a lot of. We've been checking the company's financial statements, because you had to understand if they would be able to pay certain amounts, certain budget on a monthly basis.
So this is actually, you know, despite being in the accounting department, you're really, as part of the core value proposition of that business, was being able to aggregate these payments together. I guess you're dealing with larger companies that they were doing it, and so that they didn't have to put everything on credit cards to make their accountancy easier, but therefore your accountancy was harder because you didn't have to outsource that problem more or less to you.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So then a vendor, it sounds like then you started off by taking on vendors. And then after a while, you learn, no, hold on, we've got to vet these vendors before we let them on the platform, because there was no real recourse, because in practice, that was it. So how did you go about like vetting them in the end? Did you manage to fix the problem before you left, or is it just part of that business? You're always going to get hit for some fraud.
Yeah, actually, so while I was in account receivable, and it's kind of was my like KPIs that I had to have them all in one place. And because when I joined them, it was only me and another like coworker, but then she left. So I was alone in account receivable while they've been looking for the manager. So while they've been looking for the manager, you know, I gained so much knowledge that I was the one actually that I could handle it probably, because I knew everything. I knew how backend worked, because you had to go and look at how they booked the trips, because sometimes they had fraudulent kind of movements and they've been saying, no, we haven't booked this trip, your system has a bug, you know? So you had to go for the backend to see all the things that they have done. So that was lots of work behind. But then when the manager came, I already kind of had a plan in my mind of how we can fix this problem. So, and by having lots of meetings with her, because I had to train her then how to use the system, how everything works, because the business model within the event system, it's a bit complicated how everything is integrated between different systems around. And yeah, and then at the end, we had this plan, we settled it down. So we've been checking the financial statements, we've been giving out the legal documents to our legal department. So we built up the whole process to protect the company against the fraudulent clients.
Interesting. So, I mean, you were really thrown to the lions there. That was really a tough first job. That was your first job.
Yeah, that was my first job. Exactly. Exactly.
And you were, it sounds like you were one of the most junior people there at that stage. And yet you were dealing with these massive issues. And did the leadership give you the right support? Like, do you decide what to pursue legally or not? Or was it just, no, let's just try and put the process in not to, for that to happen again?
Yeah, I think, look, before we had this process of course, those things been happening and it was a bit stressful. But once we settled up the process, it was a fully like kind of protected part of the account receivable.
What did you learn from that? Like from that now, having seen this, if you had to work in AR again, like what's the one thing you're like, hold on, I've seen this before. What would you look out for first?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is when the company has a specific strategy, right, where they're going. And if you mostly focus on just scaling up, growing and having volume, you have to think about the consequences of what might happen and how to prevent this. Because I think the most important, not just having the strategy, but having the mindset of what can happen. Like, what are the people? Because we all know that, unfortunately, we don't have any trust between people. And that's the reason why we're trying to protect ourselves. And I think that's why it's really important before you start like tackling any strategy, you have to think about the risks you might have and also the consequences. So I would say we don't even have to be all the time focused on the positive segments and positive actions. You have to also be focused on the bad stuff.
Now you're talking like a CFO. I see. You can learn. There we go. Okay. Awesome. So I'm curious about this mentor. So it sounds like you really had a trial by fire experience here. You went on to accounts, which must have been more calm, let's say, for you. And then FP&A, which is an ivory tower, sounds like by expression, by comparison. So by the time you got into FK, was that just spreadsheets and presentations and that days, or did it have its own challenges?
I mean, that was interesting experience because when I've done my first FP&A at Travel Perk, my first company, I felt that I was lacking the accounting knowledge and experience. Mm-hmm. And I was glad that I took a risk, you know, of course, being employed and being in a company for 3 years, it's comfortable. You know, everyone knows you know, like how the business cycle works and easy. So I was kind of taking a risk, leaving the company, looking for another company and just, you know, have accounting experience. And after I had it for 2 years, I decided, okay, now I'm ready fully. And I joined another company, which is the last mile logistical company, which is called PAC. And this is where I joined the FP&A team. And for around like 2 years, I had like beautiful experience of learning about how financial modeling works because they've been raising like hundreds of millions and of investment. And I've seen the proper budgeting. And I was actually the one when I joined, I was doing the whole budgeting for the whole company because it's something that they've been missing to track. And I think that's kind of a mistake also of big startups. Imagine they've been almost in a kind of a unicorn level and no one been tackling the budgeting part, which means, for example, you have different departments. You take, for example, HR and they look at their expenses and you might see that when they do hiring, they might hire some of the outsourced companies to help them to hire talents, you know, and huge money. I've seen like 50K on a monthly basis or even more. And of course, the mistake was that the budget wasn't aligned with the strategy because they were not like really focused on where they're going and why they spend money, you know? And that's the reason why when I started like building up the budgeting spreadsheets and I have thousands of transactions, imagine when I joined them, there've been like 1,200 people. And it's incredible how they kind of missed up this part because they split between headquarters and the warehouses because they do last mile logistics. And at warehouses, they had, for example, in Spain, they had more than 50, you know, and in France, they have also in UK, in Portugal. So there's lots of people involved and you're not like on track with the all the expenses you have. And I think that that was the most difficult part, because also they had lots of fraudulent transactions that has been done, and you had to tackle them to see why this big amount happened, for what it was spent for. So lots of like small details that you have to be really into, and you have to know people around as well, because the specific classification of the expense is related to a specific person. And then also under it, you have a specific provider that related to another person. So there's lots of like connection dots that you have to find around. And that was incredible work at the end.
Okay, so now the hair is going up on the back of my head, because you're speaking my language here. I mean, we see lots of, especially where you have a distributed team like that, multiple teams in different places, country managers are given their own so-called budget. Now, I want to ask about, you said that they were not aligned to the strategy. Was it just, you know, give me an example of that. Like how was the spending on the ground misaligned with what the leadership wanted that money to go on?
I think the most important experience I had, and it was at the beginning, because no one was kind of on track about the budgeting. So because they had lots of money in a bank account, right? When you have lots of them, you don't think, you just spend. You spend.
Yeah.
You have strategy, you think it's going to work, and you spend it like as much as you can. So when I was analyzing the IT department, the expenses were like huge. They had freelancers, and those freelancers, like big amounts that they have paid, which means they can focus more internally and try to kind of, you know, diversify the work between IT departments. So you don't need outsource people to come, and they cost like huge money, because of course those freelancers, they have to pay taxes, right? So it's kind of a thing why you overpay to them. And then also they had kind of issues with expenses itself within the department, because there are ways where you can make and cut the expenses. For example, there are certain providers exist in the market, right? And you can find more cheaper, which will give you the same thing, right? It's just, I know it's hard to give out the provider that you're working with for a year, for example, but you can find similar one that does the same, but they're cheaper. So you have to be all aligned in the market as well, because there's so many new companies appearing. You can make a deal with them. You can make a discount because you're a big startup and you want to promote them as well, for example. So there are many things that you can speculate your expenses. And of course, there's some of the providers that we didn't even need it because no one was using that.
I mean, I can speak to this a little bit in that I've seen, and you tell me whether this is what goes on, because I frequently see with your full-time team, you know, a problem pops up. And everyone's busy, so like, well, we probably need some help with that, you know? And they go to sort of like, let's hire, especially these days, it takes almost no effort to hire someone on all the way from Upwork to an agency. You have a very helpful recruiter there, more than happy to help place part-time and full-time staff if you need them. And rather than address the problem, sometimes, you know, it's just like, well, let's add more people and see if that helps. And let's face it, sometimes easier to do, to think about, than it is to actually fix the problem, right? So is that something you saw?
And honestly, at the end, when I went for the all the expenses, all the like head accounts as well, all the freelancers, at the end, get rid of the 50% of freelancers. That was a huge cost. And because they had the like the new CTO, and I worked with him like really closely. And when we went through each expense one by one, we've saved like huge amount of money at the end, huge amount.
And what broke?
Well, it's a bit confidential, but I would say it was around like 100K on a monthly basis.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And did the world fall apart? Was it it sounds like Elon Musk and Twitter now. So you went in, you cut half the headcount, by the sounds of it, or the cost anyway, and everything still worked. There was
that was the amazing job of that, but because I wanted to be involved in different scenarios as well, not only budgeting, because budgeting I've done before at Travelperk itself, but in PAC, I wanted to be focused on the analytical part. So I had a moment where I was handling the French entity. So I had to kind of build up all the analytical part, you know, to tell where we have mistakes, where we have like any issues around why it happened. And you had to deliver those issues within the numbers, graphs, and then you had to know what happened exactly and how we can solve it. So, and okay. Then doing like budgeting, and I was the only one. So imagine they hire IT people, they don't care, right? Just spend money because they're so important in the company. I don't know why, but in finance, there's lack of people to, you know, to control things in one place. Because I needed more people. If I would have two more people under me, imagine it will change the whole world. I mean, for the company itself as well.
So, Jane, when we scheduled this podcast, I said we're going to talk about modeling and FP&A. I thought it was going to be very academic, but it seems like you just continually get stuck in, make life hard for yourself, getting the lawyers involved, and then, you know, getting your hands dirty. So, I mean, lots of people can see that, and they let us. Surely it must have been easier for you to kind of let that slide. Okay, you know, no one else seems to be complaining. What is it in your personality that made you want to go and tackle that and not just go with the flow?
I think I have this kind of mindset of, so since the first company, I was kind of really ambitious in a way that even though I'm in the same position, no one pays me more, but my mindset wasn't like this. So I was there to learn. And I think that's the reason why maybe I didn't stay at one, let's say I could stay in account receivable and I would be like no manager 5 years ago already. But I just didn't see myself stay there. And, you know, I kind of want to grow more and more. And I think that's the reason why from account receivable, I was like, okay, I learned everything. I don't see even, it doesn't make sense to stay. So I jumped into the like more accounting side. And of course, that moment I was like, okay, there's four people like me, I probably would have a routine job. And this is what I had. I had a routine job of doing invoices, registering the accounts, but haven't had enough experience. So this is the reason why I jumped into FP&A, just to see if something I like, so then I can come back later. And that's the reason why I went to learn accounting. I saw that it's a routine job. Every month you do the same. And I realized that it's not something that I would stay for the rest of my life. And that's the reason why I jumped into FP&A. I got back. I saw everything, how it works, how it all interconnected. And then, yeah, I just made a big move of quitting a job and helping others.
Okay. So you've been in practice now, let's say, for yourself for a couple of years. You decided to, I guess it sounds like you're doing well there. You could have continued. What was the day you decided, no, I'm going to jump ship? Did you start to have clients kind of on the side first, or what gave you the confidence to know you'd be able to survive if you did jump ship?
Yes. Yeah, so I've met my business partner at the conference, and I still was working at the previous company. And this conference was more about being like as a freelancer or nomad people. More about the Web3 scene as well, that I think I was just entering this market. And I've met my business partner, and we just had a great communication about like self-beliefs, about like meaning of life. And since I was like young, I still had this mindset that I don't want to be employed all the time and work 9 to 6. But I, at that moment, just didn't know what's my kind of passion and where I have to be in what place and how I have to help people. Because I was looking at the few spectrums of like strategy, because I love strategy sessions and it's something that I'm really passionate, but also passionate about the numbers.
So you're in a kind of a startup hub. You're in Barcelona at the moment, as I understand. Exactly. I get this impression there's a lot of, what's the vibe like in Barcelona for startups? Like if I fly into Barcelona next week and I want to get to know the vibe, what do I do or where do I go?
Yeah, I think there is lots of communities, especially the co-working spaces. There is one of them, it's called Charisma. In Barcelona, it's quite famous, and he runs all the events, all the small conferences for the founders, entrepreneurs. So it's quite a huge community here. And yeah, it's just something that really motivates you as well to, you know, quit 9 to 6 job and start your own things around. And that's actually coming back to your question, to the previous one, that I was thinking for 2 months to take the risk, not to take the risk. And I've never been unemployed, so I didn't know how I would feel and how I would handle this risk. And then after 2 months, one day I decided I'm quitting now. I'm going to test myself. I'm going to see how I feel. And I also wanted to feel, what does it mean of me helping other startups? Is it easy for me to communicate with them? Because every founder, they're different. You have to find a specific way so you understand each other. And that was amazing. I quit it for 3 months. I was a freelancer. I loved it. So much.
Well, I mean, I think if you're competent, there is something to, like, no one keeps a freelancer on for fun, right? Especially if you're looking after their budgeting, right? So you've really got to earn your crust. So, you know, every month you work for a company, you've earned it. You're there. You're not a cog in the machine. It wouldn't be paying you unless they really needed you. And that's kind of like a different level of validation than you get from a monthly paycheck where, you know, there's a longer term view on things. Okay, cool. So you've been very successful. I'm starting to get a picture as to why. You decided, okay, I'm going to focus on startups. I'm enjoying this part. You decided to pick a market segment that, you know, 90% of them will be out of business in 5 years or less. And so how did you try and figure out the wheat from the chaff? How did you figure out, well, amongst the startup community, who are the people you can really help and can afford to take on a CFO? Because that's a key component here, right?
So we were trying to analyze what's our ICP, because you had to enter the market and then you have to test it who really needs the financial modeling. I would say that I had just few clients that they were on a pre-seed, but they've been already in the industry for quite long. I mean, that they already had startups before, and they know at the beginning for them, it's really important to see where they might go and what's the potential, especially within the market, right? So you have an idea, you know how you're going to grow, how you're going to do the expansion, but you don't know how the market is big. And maybe you have to tackle different countries, but not only the one that you are located inside.
So these are loss-making startups, are they? And on a growth trajectory?
Yeah, so they're on the pre-seed, so which means they don't have any MVP yet. So they're just figuring out what exactly is going to work. So I would say the market product fix. So this is what they're trying kind of to fix around. But lately, what I realized that more founders on a level between like seed and series A, this is where they need the financial modeling, because they have MVP, they have traction, they have some of the historical data. So there's something that you can prove and show to VCs, which is the most important part, right? And I think that was really big insight for me as well, that most of them at the beginning, they don't know, have no idea about the strategy, especially I would say on the seed level. They struggle a lot with the strategy. They might have something inside, but they have no idea how the strategy will work on the numbers level. And that's the key point of that, right? So you can have three different scenarios of, okay, if we tackle this strategy, how it would affect the business. If we change the strategy, how this would affect. So this kind of brainstorming, it's so important before you start doing any actions and just, you know, going within the direction and how it might affect.
So let's put some meat on those bones. You mentioned that, you know, a lot of it sounds like you're effectively kind of working as an investor. You're trying to pick the ones you think are going to work. So you're taking the risk of like being an angel investor and working with these people. And Formacar was one of your early clients. I think they're a good example of someone who had energy, but not necessarily a plan or even a model. So tell us a bit about that.
Yes. So when I was in contact with them and they were just curious how their model looked like, and they needed some, we call it like a health checkup and see how the company is doing and what type of model they have. And when I had a chance to check the model, and it, you know, sometimes I just need 5 minutes to realize how it was done. And I've seen that it was made really not professionally. There is a specific structure. There is a specific kind of logic behind of how you build up the model. So, and I haven't seen it. And they've done, for example, you know, in the cell when you have an A, which you cannot have it in the financial model that you present to investors. It has to be super clean, super clear. And then it has to be all, you know, strategically really placed on the right kind of direction, because it was messed up completely. There were no market analysis at all. They had business plan and they had financial model, which haven't related to each other, you know? And that's kind of a really scary moment, because when you go to VC, they look at the business model, and they look at financial model, and they look if they're kind of the same, you know, if they're telling the same story. And financial model, it tells the story. It's a reinterpretation of the business model. And they haven't had it. So, and I gave them kind of I usually do like a free calls. It's kind of, I give them an idea of what we can change, how we can improve, what's wrong. And when they had session with me, they realized that they need like a business model to be reviewed, and also the financial model. And at the end, we've done the financial model from zero, because they hadn't had the strategy how they're going to acquire clients. Nothing. They haven't had the market analysis. So you go blind. You have the model, but you just have it as just for the, you know, out of sake, just to have it.
We'll talk about what exactly is in the model. That, I mean, this rings a bell for me, in that for several times in my career, I've started businesses that, you know, mathematically could never have succeeded. Now, at one stage, I was selling text messages for 20 cents. I was charging 10 cents, and I didn't do the math. I'd need to sell millions of text messages just to be able to pay the rent. And I never did that. So that might sound super obvious and stupid if you've got a finance background, but lots of founders do that. They're all brim and bluster, if you like, and it's fake it till you make it and all this sort of stuff. And then, you know, you gotta at some stage the rubber's gotta hit the road. So when you say the model, what is that? Is that a cash flow projection? Is it what's the foundation of a good model for you? Does it incorporate other KPIs? Is it a spreadsheet, a Google sheet? Is it PDF? What is it? What's it look like?
Ideally, because I had an experience working with VC as well. So because when I was doing a freelance job, I was on the side of working VC. So I was seeing like different like financial models. But usually the best one is, first of all, you have to have kind of the market analysis. So you have to have kind of a vision of where they're going, what's the benchmark, what are the competitors, what's the pricing. So you have to know kind of the market potential they have. Then you go to the kind of revenue analysis of how you are going to acquire the clients. It either can be for sales, like BDs, or it can be for marketing. And then if they go for marketing, what's the marketing strategy of how, let's say you go for the expense of the marketing, and depending on their strategy, you calculate what will be the cost per client, because that's really important. Then you can understand of what's the budget for the marketing strategy, and then how many of them you can acquire. So, and then you build up the whole like revenue analysis based on the marketing, I would say, budget. And then after having this kind of, then you do budgeting. You're like, okay, so this is kind of our strategy. This is how much money we have, or either we're going to have the investment of 1 million. If we have 1 million, so this will be the budget in order to reach kind of this type of revenue. And then you go to head accounts as well. So you kind of see the picture on of how many people they would need to reach certain KPIs. And then afterwards, you go to the free statement analysis, which is P&L, then cash flow, then balance sheet. And then afterwards, you do, I would say it's called funding ask tab. It's where if you want to get the 1 million of the investment, how are you going to spend those money? Because investors, this is the number one thing that they're going to ask. So asking, and how are you going to spend those money? And then I do the valuation, which is the most important part as well. So we'll look at different methods of the valuation depending on the company industry, depending on what level they are as well, because they're different methods. And then at the end, it's like a cherry on the top. Then we do all the unit economics, all the KPIs, because once they see the picture of how they're going, where they're going, you're building up like main metrics of the company so that they know what's the most important things that they have to tackle and track on in the future.
Okay. So you covered a lot there, and you sort of glossed over something. I'm reminded of, I don't know if you've ever seen that cartoon of a scientist drawing a very complicated math sum on a blackboard. And then at the very end, you go, some magic happens here. And then the outcome happens, right? So there's a couple of bits in there which are, it's hard to do. So let's talk about something I'm familiar with, like a SaaS company. When you're putting a model together, how do you sort of benchmark what's a reasonable model or a, you know, a cost of acquiring a customer, or how do you, for those missing numbers in the spreadsheet where scientific world does, is it just that, or is there a better way to go around it? Are there benchmarks or places that you can use to reasonably put in the assumptions?
Usually, so when we do kind of a benchmark or market analysis, there are like certain platforms nowadays, especially there are like different agencies as well that they do like a market analysis, because unfortunately when you go, even when you use ChatGPT, he's not going to give you the accurate, not even accurate, I would say they don't have a database which is available in Google from where they can tackle out the data. So that's the reason why there are like platforms that where you can enter and just do kind of the market research. You tackle all the information and then do analysis of the TAM, SAM and SOM, which is most important. So the biggest market potential, the middle size, and then what's your target, the actual target. So, I mean, there are different spectrums and you can interpret the information differently. But usually we're trying to get as much information as we can, not just general, you know, what's the population of the country or how many are buying this and this. So we're just going super, super deeply into the market analysis.
So proprietary database, so I can use Sales Navigator or Zoom Info to get graphic, like how many people have a particular job title, for example, that would buy this service, how many are there, and you work that back and then you say, okay, you know, a typical sales efficiency would be whatever. Yeah, I'm going to need so many leads. I'm going to need 50 leads for every customer. And you just use those industry benchmarks. I guess that's where the genius of filling this in comes in. So I want to talk a little bit about how you've grown your business and like how you've managed to like you have your initial clients through networking, I hear. Then you had an interesting experience with a networking client, I think you met, called Obertech, and some Excel problems they were having.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's something that we're trying to deliver to other people, to founders, that what makes the model finance different is that when we enter the project, we act and we think as our own business. So we are not just here, you know, to make money and, you know, all do financial model and then leave. So our purpose is just to make the connection with the, like with the team, with the founder, see their mission, vision, and just trying to see their strategy. And we're trying to make the best way possible. And this is something what we deliver to clients. And usually it's word of the mouth, right? If someone really happy with it, and then he has a friend that he's a founder as well, he was like, look, there is a great agency, just go with them, they will help you a lot. Also, we do, I do free workshops sometimes as well, depending on the conference itself. I think that's really important also to give out something for free, even for people, just as my own experience maybe that I had, and just to give out of something for them. We also do kind of networking outside in different like co-working spaces. We also focus like on the personal branding, and that's the reason why we're not focused itself on the agency, like do all the marketing promotions. We usually do, but we do it more as the personal branding. So people that they're aware that they're professionals behind, that they do this work. And it's not the ones, you know, you see a lot in Upwork, CFI certification, you know, and probably there were no experience in the finance. Maybe they had just a bit. But the people I have as well, they went for the whole cycle, because to do financial modeling, you have to be like as a professional within the different segments of finance, because they're all then correlated to each other in the financial model.
Sure. So that's why you're doing this podcast, I guess, try and get your expertise across. Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. Listen, we have a lot to planned out to talk about, but we've only got through some of it, but I want to be respectful of everyone's time. So what I'd like to do here is just sort of round things off. First of all, let me ask, how can people get in touch with you, Jane, if they'd like to actually have heard and they want to hear more from you?
Sure. I think the easiest way, if they're really interested to have any conversation, or they either can visit our website, which is called modo.finance. Easy. We'll be the first one to jump in. And then we can book a free call. And then I will jump into the call. I will have a conversation with you. And even though you have any questions that you struggle in your business within the financial part or anything about strategy. I'm doing that for free, just for people to give any help. And if we see any synergies, if we see something that we can work on, feel free to, you know, to continue and by any emails or messaging. Also, they can visit my LinkedIn as well. And just, I'm really active there. And they also can see some posts from me, because usually on a weekly basis, I'm trying to post something about either something new in the market or anything about the financial industry. So I'm trying to be active there as well. And I also communicate with the people there as well.
Okay, great. I'll follow you because I'm trying to up my LinkedIn game. I'm terrible at LinkedIn and I'm trying to learn how to do it. Okay, well, we have a traditional question here to wrap up the podcast, which is, you know, who's your business hero and why, Jane?
I would say my hero is Jamie Dimon. He is the CEO of JP Morgan Chase and one of the biggest banks in the world. And he's known like for successfully leading the bank through the like tough times, especially during the 2008 when we had like financial crisis. And I think he's a great leader in the sense of within the hardest time of when the crisis happened, he was the one to take like the risk and to protect his own bank and just to go through the like, you know, hard time to take risks. And then he made great decisions. And I think what makes him stand out is his focus on the long-term success instead of just quick profits. So like he believes in careful risk management and what helped the bank to avoid the worst of the financial crisis. So I think he's really like great person in that sense.
A banker with a heart, so I heard. Interesting. Okay. All right. Okay, well, I'll check him out. They talk about him on the All In podcast sometimes. I've heard his name float around. I think he was a presidential, one of the people they were talking about there. So interesting pick. I must dig more into him. If I'm honest, I know this is very superficial, but his name put me off. He sounds like a superhero or something. I don't know. Like, but I'll have to dig into it now based on your recommendation. Thanks, Jane. And thank you very much for listening this far. If you have been listening this far, this deep into the podcast, congratulations. You get a special gift that no one else gets, which is you'll be able to go to procurementexpress.com/partners. And right now, I've just published this week a webinar for fractional CFOs just like Jane who want to learn how other fractional CFOs are selling our Procurement Express to deliver value, not selling actually, just working with Procurement Express to deliver value to their customers. So thanks for listening this long. And there is something I want to say, there's something in the webinar that would be worthwhile listening to if you're a fractional CFO. I've talked to many fractional CFOs now, and I've come up with a four-step formula for explaining the value of what a great CFO can do in your business. I don't think this is controversial to say, but not all fractional CFOs do a great job of selling themselves. Having listened to dozens now, I think it's one of the most powerful hires you can make in your business. But most CFOs are terrible at explaining it how they do that. So if you're interested in working with us or you're just interested in how you can deliver more value and explain that value to CEOs, I recommend you try it out. So thanks for listening. Thank you, Jane. We had so much to talk about. You're brilliant. You had such great detail. I think you're experience really came out. I love all the nuts and bolts that we got into, the personal experience you brought to it. You've been very open. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, James, for giving me this chance and just sharing my own experience, my kind of own way of thinking. And just, you know, I think people would appreciate kind of that you're here for giving out so much like knowledge, experience behind. And I think you're doing a great job as well. And really thankful to be here and just, you know, to share my experience around.